I'm Roger.
Quiet, please, ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. Although on the day after a significant political assassination yesterday and on the day where America marks 24 years since the terrorist attacks on America on 9/11. Glad to be with you, though, and glad to take your phone calls on a day like today. We usually call today Conspiracy Theory Thursday. There's plenty of that as well. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's always right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. If you happen to be a naysayer, and we love naysayers on this show, for more than 25 years, every naysayer has gone to the head of the line. You get to go first. You just have to make your point, make your best argument, and then stick around for a few questions from me. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio on a daily basis. Now, we've got some things to talk about. One of them, the poll on X today, I decided because of what happened yesterday, should we send a message with a death penalty to those who commit acts of political murder? The governor of Utah, Spencer Cox, had honored Charlie Kirk, who was assassinated yesterday, and reminded the nation that his state still has the death penalty, speaking at a press conference only hours after Kirk was shot to death at Utah Valley University. Cox vowed to hold the killer accountable to the fullest extent of the law. And the latest update on that, the FBI has released pictures of the killer, or the person believed to be the killer, when they catch him, when they charge him, when they indict him, when they put him on trial, and when he is convicted, he will be legally the killer. Until then, he is not. He has a presumption of innocence, and the state has to prove the case. But when somebody is convicted of a political murder, now, if you ask me, well, what do you mean by that? I got some questions yesterday after the shooting of Charlie Kirk and after we learned of his death. I got people asking, well, you're calling it an assassination. Well, assassination is not just for people of high-ranking office. We describe Dr. Martin Luther King as assassinated, and he held no political office at all. So I think assassination applies when someone kills you because of your political beliefs. I think we would apply it that way. Now, what does political murder mean? Because if you had the death penalty, then it would be up to a jury to decide whether or not the person convicted of murdering you did it for political reasons and not for all the other 1,001 stupid reasons that people use to commit murder. So should we send the message? Say, if you commit a political murder in America, you can be put to death, but only if a jury decides that you deserve it. You can find the X poll at Lars Larson Show on X. You can find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Well, the FBI now has the rifle that was used in yesterday's assassination of the most prominent millennial conservative commentator in America, Charlie Kirk. And that means they should soon have his killer in custody, or accused killer in this case. Charlie Kirk died when a single bullet from what we now know is a .30-06 Mauser rifle tore out his throat as he sat in front of thousands of college students at Valley University in Orem, Utah. Kirk founded Turning Point USA a dozen years ago, and he spoke to college crowds regularly, and he knew that his free speech made him a target for the political left. In fact, he talked about that as well. He reflected that, he said, in fact, this was one of his most recent comments about it, at the core of a liberal is a person who will use the sword if they have it. They are very violent people. That is much the same point that I tried to make yesterday. And that was, there is an awful lot of violence talk from the left, and it is directed at the right. It is when people on the left labeled those of us on the right as Nazis, as haters. And the fact is, when you say, well, if somebody engages in hate speech, There was actually a commentator at MSNBC who got fired yesterday because he said, when you do hateful things will happen. And what he meant was, he meant to blame Charlie Kirk for his own murder. Now, that was out of line, and Matthew Dowd got fired for that, and I think that MSNBC was right to fire him. Earlier this year, though, a survey found that 55% of self-identified liberals in America believe the murder of public figures is justified. Politicians on the left egg them on. VP candidate Tim Walz talked about Donald Trump's modern-day Gestapo. Are you then surprised when people engage in acts of violence when you've labeled the political right as Nazis? Less than 20 years have passed since Barack Hussein Obama told a Philadelphia political rally, if they bring a knife to a fight, we bring a gun. And yes, I checked. He did actually say that. In fact, we used to have a soundbite of him saying that. I don't think we have the audio anymore. We have now seen the attempted assassination of a congressman, Steve Scalise, the man from Louisiana, a man with a gun outside the home of a Supreme Court Justice, Brett Kavanaugh, who planned to kill him. He was stopped, fortunately. Two attempted assassinations of President Trump, and now we have Charlie Kirk. And then when people like Democrat Senator Elizabeth Warren, known for faking her background as a Native American, who's asked about violent political rhetoric.
Oh, please. Right. Why don't you start with the President of the United States? Right? And every ugly meme he has posted.
Yeah, hold on a second. They're asking you about violent rhetoric and whether or not it led to Charlie Kirk being assassinated. And your first response is, take a look at all the nasty stuff that Donald Trump has posted. Actually, this is one of the things that ought to bother people the most. And that is that you're said, well, he said hateful things. Do you know what the left thinks is hateful? Suggesting that you shouldn't murder unborn baby boys and girls. They think that it is hateful for you to say that because you're trying to control a woman's body. They think that it is hateful if you say we should have a solid border in America and the only people who get into America are those who come in legally and lawfully, more than 1 million people every year. They think that is hateful. Some of us, I think Charlie Kirk and me certainly, have said that we shouldn't have doctors who cut the body parts off teenage boys and girls to try to transform them into the opposite gender and mark up their bodies with hormones that will change them forever. The left thinks that kind of speech is hateful. If that's defined as hate speech, then I embrace it. I will embrace the right to life. I will embrace the protection of babies and the protection of teenage boys and girls from the medical Mengeles of the world. By the way, one little hint that we've got possibly about the motivation of the assassin yesterday. The Wall Street Journal reports that ammunition found with the alleged assassin's gun was marked with transgender messages, and a screenshot says the location of the firearm appears to match the suspect's route of travel. The spent cartridge was still chambered in addition to three unspent rounds at the top of the feed magazine. All cartridges had engraved wording on them expressing transgender and anti-fascist ideology. And there are still people on left-wing media today asking, we don't know the motivation of what caused this person, whoever it was that pulled that trigger, to fire that shot and take the life of Charlie Kirk. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the conversation, it's 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. And in this case, I want to warn you about something that is coming out from the Office of the Superintendent of Public Instruction. This Chris Reichdahl guy, the guy who insists that there are not just two genders among children, that there are actually many more genders than that. Yeah, that kind of nonsense. Well, now he's warning that people may be weaponizing the results of tests that show the progress or lack thereof in the public schools. And in fact, he says there is a moment to privatize the public sector, and the deliberate misrepresentation and subsequent weaponization of test scores is a key tactic. If you've ever heard that half our students can't read or do math, you were lied to. Well, you know what they've done? They've changed the definition a bit. According to Chris Reichdahl's office, 71% of students demonstrated what they call foundational grade level knowledge at or above, you know, the minimum in English language arts, 63% in math. Just over half of the students, 50.8% in English, 40.7% in math, met grade level standards, almost unchanged from 2024. So, Chris Reichdahl is saying with one part of his mouth, if you've ever heard that half our students can't read or do basic math, well, I want to try the math on you here. The numbers he released say 50.8% of students can do English. So half of our students can't read. Okay. And 40.7% in math met the grade level standard, meaning 60% did not meet the grade level standard. And yet Chris Reichdahl would have you believe it's a lie if you say half our students can't read or do math. He says they have foundational knowledge, whatever that means. And then take a look at what the national scores show. In 12th graders, average math scores were the worst since the current test began in 2005. Reading was below any point since that assessment started back in 1992, more than 30 years ago. The share of 12th graders who were proficient slid by 2 percentage points to 35% in reading and 22% in math. Washington State does a bit better, but it's still true when you say 50% of the kids can't read or do math. Today's question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery, and you get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. If a public school teacher posted a note celebrating yesterday's assassination of Charlie Kirk, should that teacher keep his job? Well, I made some phone calls this morning because there is a post online. I'm not going to share the teacher's name, but at Neil Armstrong Middle School, where I called to have a conversation with the principal of the school, who I was told was on the phone answering calls and questions about the teacher in question. The teacher had made an absolutely evil post about the assassination of Charlie Kirk, and I will share what was posted. And I told the school, I don't know if this post is real or not. But the young lady who answered the phone said, well, the principal is on the phone right now answering questions. I said, if it is true, then I want to ask some questions about the teacher. If it is not true, then I want to clear it up so people understand that. Here is the alleged post. Hearing that Charlie Kirk got, this is from a teacher at Neil Armstrong Middle School. Hearing that Charlie Kirk got shot and died really brightened up my day. Nobody deserves it, but some are asking for it. For anybody that wants to creep my wall and tell me how upsetting this is, Charlie was a, and then he used a word that you cannot use in on radio. Charlie was a blanking ghoul who got on TV after every school shooting and mass shooting and defended guns. He wanted us to support the gun in this case. See more in comments. I'm not going to name the teacher. Well, subsequent to that, the school district, the Forest Grove School District, has now posted online that apparently the teacher did make those comments. And as a result of that, the school says, but he did it on his own private social media and he did it on his own time. Now, I've heard this kind of excuse from the schools before where they say, well, it wasn't on school time. And it was on his own social media site. I would love to ask the principal of Neil Armstrong Middle School, who I made a phone call to a couple of hours ago, if he used the N-word on his own time and his own group of friends, would that be okay? If he did anything else that was objectionable in that way, like celebrating the death of somebody, but he did it on his own time. I would ask you parents, if a public school teacher, posted a note celebrating the assassination of Charlie Kirk. Do you want that teacher in front of your kids? And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to everybody who got online for whatever reason, right or left, teacher or non-teacher, and celebrated the assassination of an American citizen yesterday. That is absolutely evil. And frankly, I hope that your employers question whether or not they want to keep you on the payroll. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They've done it for me. I've seen it with my own eyes, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Call them up at 855-CAP-THAT. Manuel Castaneda wrote to me, Lars, we were in Gold Beach yesterday. That's on the South Oregon coast when the assassination happened. It was very heartbreaking. Rosa started to cry. The idea that taking somebody's life because they don't agree with you has to come to an end. What good is having free speech in the Constitution if you get killed for saying what others don't agree with? I was particularly intrigued by the two people he chose at the bottom of the interview. I probably would have picked them or others in that group, signed Manuel Castaneda. Manuel, thank you very much. I appreciate the email. Send those emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me go first to Jerry. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've been listening to your show for a long time. Reference the death penalty for political violence or any other type of violence.
Political murder.
We could,
I mean, if you punch somebody in the nose, I'm not going to suggest the death penalty for punching somebody in the nose in a political argument. But if you murder somebody,
I meant to say murder one. Okay. Well, with society the way it is, I don't think people would go for it legislative-wise. But I think we should always lock a murder one conviction up for life and no chance of parole. And right now we have people get out on parole. And I think it should be a federal requirement as well as a state requirement. If convicted of murder one, you are incarcerated for the rest of your life.
The problem is if you're locked up under a state law, the state can say we changed the rules, and they do it all the time, unfortunately. Let's go to John. Hey, John, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
First of all, we don't need psychopathic preachers. Anyways, we haven't had a staff.
I can't hear you very well, John. Can you speak a little more clearly into that Obama phone?
We haven't had a staff at large since Booth. Should anyone giving aid and comfort to this assassin be properly charged?
John, you know, the call is still so muddy, I can't understand what you're saying. But, and I've got pretty good ears, but I appreciate the call. Shoot me an email. I'll take care of it that way. Oh, and to add to your question, Lars, Ann writes in, would a student get away with that kind of post? Yeah, I have a feeling the school would have something different to say about that. It's Thursday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland. Truth be told, Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It is another one of those red letter days when, for the second time in the history of this entire show, I welcome back an elected Democrat from a Pacific Northwest state government, and that is the Secretary of State, Tobias Reid. Secretary Reid, welcome back.
Thanks very much. I'm here from Pendleton, so it's nice to talk with you.
Are you out there for Roundup?
You bet. I'm the Secretary of State for all of Oregon, so the chance to get out here and talk to people in this beautiful part of the state. Actually, we've been on a tour visiting all of the heroes of democracy, the 36 county clerks around Oregon. And yesterday we visited our 31st in Morrow County. So it's a great time to be out in Pendleton and connect with everyone who's here for Roundup.
Well, I've been to Roundup a lot of times, but I want to get on to the things I want to talk to you about because there are so many things I want to discuss with you. But let's start with this. Back when you were the state treasurer, Were you very concerned and immediately after you left that job about the fact that PERS money was being invested in extraordinarily risky ventures and that they were likely to either lose money or not make much money?
Well, I think you know, you've seen the memo that I wrote. The answer to that question is yes. We always have an obligation to make sure that those funds are as productive as possible because they this is what retirees rely on, 400,000 people to buy groceries and pay rent, and our obligation is to do as much as we possibly can with that. So we have to be careful and watch out for every sort of risk, and that's what I was trying to articulate in that memo, and that's an accurate reflection of my thought at the time.
You know, Secretary of State Reid, you're not concerned about the group, or you have not put the group up first that I'm most concerned with. I mean, retirees are fine, and I do want to make sure they get paid what they're owed. But you know who I'm concerned about? I'm concerned that when PERS... What, go ahead. You answer the question. Well, I think you're ahead.
Well, I can guess, because I do understand the impact, too. It's on the daily lives of Oregonians and the experiences that they have as Oregonians. When we, you know, I listen to your show. I know some of what you're thinking some of the time. I do think this, you know, the impact of those choices flows down to the budgets of states and cities and the experiences people have. And as Oregonians, that's also why it's really important in the policy debate to make sure that we're focusing on the things that we do to make a better economy happen in Oregon. That's relying not on one industry or one geography. Well, so all of this is connected. But the
and here's what I'm concerned about, Secretary of State Reid, and that is when PERS makes bad investments and PERS falls short, yes. They have to turn to the taxpayers and say, number one, either you all have to pay a whole lot more money in taxes to make up the shortfall we created, or number two, your communities are going to lose teachers, cops, firefighters, and paramedics. And I think that's it. So why didn't you say something about it?
Well, I did. And the interesting thing is just about being, when you're on a board that is responsible for $100 billion, that's a, you know, serious fiduciary responsibility. And the eyes of the financial industry and investors and analysts and everything are on us. So it's really important to be careful what we say publicly that does not put us into a disadvantage. And that's what I was being careful about. But it doesn't mean, as you can tell from the memo, that I wasn't asking those questions internally and really pushing our team to make sure that we are doing everything we can to watch out for those risks. If we could have had a crystal ball that knew exactly what every investment was going to do, you can bet we would have got that crystal ball and made the decisions that would be in the interest of Oregonians. But managing these uncertainties really just underscores, I think, how important it is for us to be looking for every piece that we can get to make good decisions and to be focused on the policies that build the kind of economy that offers opportunities and offers more good investments for us to make.
Okay, but I want my audience to understand how colossally risky this was. Because they invested the money the way they did, they made less money. Tell me if I'm wrong about this. They made less money for the PERS fund than they would have made if they just walked into a brokerage and said, put me in the Dow 500 or put me in the, you know, some index of a broad range of stocks. They'd have made more money as a know-nothing investor just saying, stuff it in the stock market, you know, across a spread of stocks. They'd have made more money that way than these risky private equity investments, correct?
The challenge of all of this is that if we pick a specific time period and we know it, you know, retrospectively, we know what the outcome was. If we look forward and say, here are your choices, you don't know with any certainty. Our challenge in the pension fund is to invest over, you know, 30 years, not a 1 year or 2 year period. And the numbers are what they are. I'm not defending the outcomes. But you have to make decisions going forward in a way that maximizes risk-adjusted returns. If you did the passive thing, it might come out ahead sometimes, and it might come out sometimes behind. So the important thing is to look at those numbers over the long run, and that's why, again, it's about managing risk with every tool we've got so that we're making the best outcomes for Oregonians, for taxpayers, meeting our obligations to retirees, and being able to invest in an economy and the teachers and firefighters and public health nurses that make our state what it is.
Secretary of State Reid, when you wrote the memo, you said, this is really risky, and I'm going to bring it up. You said, you even said you were sounding like a broken record. You'd apparently said it so often. So they were investing in private equity. It wasn't a good idea. It was very risky then when you wrote the memo. Are they still investing PERS money that way today?
Yes. The investment council meetings are public. Those decisions are public. And the thing about
why are they still doing it the same dumb way?
Well, I don't know that it's, I mean, look, they're making the decisions at this point. The question is how we make those decisions, and what data is into it. And it's a good question to ask the current treasurer and the current members of the investment council. I have my opinions as an individual, but I'm not the treasurer anymore.
I'd love to have you talk the treasurer into coming on. He's another one of those wallflowers like Gina Kotek and others who don't want to come on
Elizabeth
the show
Steiner.
Like you do.
Elizabeth Steiner is the treasurer. You're thinking of Dan Rayfield, maybe. Okay.
Well, no, I'm not talking about the attorney general, but so get her to come on. I'd love to ask her if it was dumb then and if it lost money, because you kind of dodged my question. I said, if they had just put this in a spread of stocks instead of private equity, would they have made more?
In that specific time period, the answer is yes. But the problem is you don't know that on a go-forward basis.
Mind if I ask you a couple of questions? I know that you sent out a lot of campaign messages about Donald Trump's so-called attack on vote by mail. You're still confident in vote by mail?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's not an attack on the president. It's an attack on his attack on the Constitution. I think he's forgotten Article 1, Section 4, which says very clearly that states run elections, not presidents. If he's concerned, I'll work with the president. I'll work with anyone who is interested in securing that and protecting the heroes of democracy. These county clerks that I visited are under real attack. I visited one who was talking about how happy she was to have installed bulletproof glass in her elections office. The fact that she has to do that is really terrible on its face.
Okay.
But in the next breath, she was also looking at the top, saying there's a gap up there between the bulletproof glass and the top where someone could throw an incendiary over it.
That's well, then let me ask you a quick question before we run out of time. You found a bunch of illegal aliens and foreign nationals in the voter rolls. Have you checked all the voters in the voter rolls to make sure that they're all legitimate voters as of today?
Well, that's not a question that can be answered because the voter roll is not a static thing. It's updated regularly. People are coming off. They're going on. We have added a ton of new controls and checks to our processes, and there's not one citizenship list. Even the Social Security database does not get updated after a naturalization ceremony. So we've got work to do for sure. But
that is the Secretary of State, and I always appreciate his time, Secretary of State Tobias Reid, the only Democrat in the last 30 years to come up with this program, and I congratulate him. I want him to bring the treasurer with him next time. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, let's talk about...
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got jumped like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. This segment of the show comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Our poll on X today. Should we send a message with the death penalty for those who commit acts of political murder? This comes after yesterday's political assassination of Charlie Kirk in Orem, Utah. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, something I'd mentioned in passing, because I was still doing my due diligence as we hit program time today, it has to do with Neil Armstrong Middle School. Now, I've made my call to the school. I asked to talk to the principal. I was told she was very, very busy answering a lot of phone calls from concerned citizens. Well, what were those concerned citizens concerned about? Well, at Neil Armstrong Middle School, what they were concerned about was a report that was posted today. I'm not going to use the name of the teacher, but at some point I will. We've got this nailed down enough. Who posted yesterday Hearing that Charlie Kirk got shot and died really brightened up my day. Nobody deserves it, but some are asking for it. For anybody who wants to creep my wall, this is from apparently Facebook, and tell me how upsetting this is, Charlie was a blanking ghoul who got on, he didn't say blanking, but he used a word I can't use, who got on TV after every school shooting and mass shooting and defended guns. He wanted us to support the gun in this case. Now, what happened? I called Neil Armstrong Middle School, asked to talk to the principal. The principal, I was told, would call me back at some point when she was done answering all of the other phone calls that were coming in from concerned parents. Now, Neil Armstrong Middle School appears to have confirmed it because they put out a message to families just a short time ago. To Neil Armstrong Middle School families, the Forest Grove School District was made aware of inflammatory comments made by a teacher at Neil Armstrong Middle School on social media. These comments were made on his private social media account while off duty. The district does not condone violence nor the celebration of violence. Our top priority is to protect the right of students to a safe and welcoming environment. Our policies prohibit the sharing or teaching of personal political views in our school classrooms. I think this is completely inadequate, and I'll tell you why. Let's say you've got a student at Neil Armstrong Middle School, and let's say he goes on his own private social media outside of school hours, and he uses the N-word, or he threatens people, or he celebrates the fact that one of his fellow students met an untimely end. Do you suppose the middle school would say, well, it happened on his social media, and it was outside of school hours, so we really don't care? I don't think they would. Let me give you an alternative about what has happened, and that is a letter that was sent out today by the superintendent of schools in Florida, the commissioner of education. It has been brought to, this is not in Oregon or Washington or Idaho, this is in Florida. It has been brought to my attention that some Florida educators have posted despicable comments on social media regarding the horrific assassination of Charlie Kirk. These few are not a reflection of the great high-quality teachers who make up the majority. Nevertheless, I will be conducting an investigation of every educator who engages in this vile, sanctionable behavior. That sounds like Neil Armstrong Middle School is saying, not on our time, not on our dime, not on our social media, not our problem. To your calls. Now, if you're one of the parents out there, do you want a teacher who celebrates the death of any human being in front of your kids in middle school? And call me up, and if you do, tell me why. Let's go to Tim. Hey, Tim, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Longtime listener. Great show.
Thank you.
I heard a fella here just a few minutes ago on your show talking about the death penalty, you know, over unfortunately losing Charlie. I think that's a wonderful thing. Not life in prison. I don't want to support them. I think they should be put to death, and unfortunately we don't use the death penalty enough as it is, but I don't want to support them. So I think the death penalty should be for those people that assassinate or people that are running for office or whatever. And also one other thing I want to say about the schools, I think that's a great idea. Whoever come up with arming the teachers that want to be armed, I think should be allowed to do so. That's
and until recently in Oregon, you could actually carry a gun as a teacher. Now, to a large extent, you can't because the legislature made it illegal. And Tim, one of the scariest statistics I know is that 92% of all mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. The majority of America is not a gun-free zone, but 92% of the mass shootings happen in gun-free zones. Only 8% of them happen in gun-friendly zones, and people should take that to heart. Is your kid's school a gun-free zone? Good. Well, bad. Then your kid is very much at risk. Let's go to Fred. Hey, Fred, we're close to the top of the hour. What's on your mind?
Well, you just interviewed the Secretary of State, and he said that they clean the voter rolls every year. Well, my father-in-law died in 2012. They sent me his ballot every year. I kept it unopened for 10 years before they ever took him off. And I checked to make sure he wasn't voting out of the grave, and he didn't do that. But they kept sending his ballot to me, and I kept them. They don't clean the voter rolls up, Lars, not at all.
No, and in fact, what I'd asked him was, because they found a bunch of foreign nationals and illegal aliens last year. And the reason was, when we talked to Tobias Reed the last time, I said, how many have you checked? 1.4 million. How many voters are there? 3.4 million. are you going to check the other 2 million? And he basically said, we will when we get around to it. And apparently they have not gotten around to it yet. Fred, thanks for the call. It's the Radio Northwest Network. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson is a...
So, in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. Utah allows open carry of guns on most campuses, but Utah Valley, where Charlie Kirk was shot yesterday, has some restrictions. Should American college campuses throughout this country allow open carry to try to keep kids safe, students safe? I shouldn't say kids when it's college, but... in this case, I don't think open carry would have made a difference in the case of Charlie Kirk, because you had an armed sniper who shot from a high vantage point, and they believe that they may be getting much closer to catching this person. But I thought I'd talk about what the research shows, and the man who knows that best is Dr. John Lott, president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author, among other books, of More Guns, Less Crime. Dr. Lott, welcome back.
Well, it's good to talk to you again, Lars. I wish it was under different circumstances.
I wish it were, too. And, in fact, yesterday, during the aftermath of what happened at that college campus in Utah, I looked up, and the University of Utah and Utah Valley University both do have somewhat liberal policies when it comes to guns, don't they?
Yeah, well, I mean, the state of Utah is one of the best states with regard to concealed carry with regard to K through 12 or universities.
But in fact, what would have made the difference yesterday, if anything?
Well, I don't think that would have made a difference. Look, if you're talking about something like a mass public shooting where somebody's going after a lot of different targets, you know, where the goal is just to kill as many people so they can get media attention, having somebody with a concealed carry can make a huge difference. Because when after they shoot one person, people have a chance to go and respond and go and stop the person that's doing the attack. And since these individuals, I mean, just one, just have to read their diaries and manifestos to see that time after time, their goal is simply to kill as many people as possible so they can get media attention. And if you can convince them to begin with that they're not going to be able to kill that many people because somebody... there, somebody that they won't be able to identify quickly will be able to go and stop them, you may be able to keep them from committing the crime to begin with. But when you're talking about an assassination where there's only one person that's going to be shot, having concealed carry permits really isn't going to help you very much.
Nope,
because
it's not.
By the time you realize that something's happened, the damage has already been done.
In fact, the gunman was already fleeing by that time and managed to both escape the campus, get into the woods, ditch his gun, and now he's on the run. But it appears they have a fairly good picture of him now, and they also have the rifle and some of his ammunition in hand. What has that told us?
Well, I mean, if you can believe the news reports, it looks like this individual is another kind of person who thinks that Trump is a fascist. He's very concerned about transgender types issues. I mean, I guess we'll have to see more, but this is not going to be the first person. I mean, the Minneapolis shooting that we just had, the person had written anti-Trump transgender messages on his you know, magazines that he had and on his gun. So it seems like this individual may be copying that. I mean, I guess I thought it was just odd at first, but he was shot. Charlie Kirk was shot during a question about shooting by transsexuals or transgender individuals. And so, you know, it may not have been a coincidence that it happened at that time. But look, you know, for your first question, one of my biggest pet peeves with the media has been that while these mass public shooters keep on explicitly explaining over and over again why they pick the targets that they do. You know, in the Minneapolis Catholic school shooter is a perfect example of this. He described in great detail that he wanted to go to a place where his victims were disarmed because that would make it easier for him to go and kill more people. And while the media will go and talk about, you know, well, maybe he did it because his mom used to work there. Well, maybe, but that's not what he talked about. They go into detail about that he idolized these other school shooters. Well, that's true, but he was talking about them in the context of learning from them and mirroring what they did in terms of picking places that were gun-free zones so they'd be easier for him to kill people. I mean, he even talked about even the time of day that he would go because he didn't want to go in the morning or the late afternoon when people would be dropping off students at the school or picking them up because he was worried that one of the parents might have a concealed carry permit and that might make it difficult for him to do it. So he wanted to do it in the middle of the day and he wanted to go to a place where he knew his victims were unarmed. But yet you search in vain for national media or even local media coverage about those parts of their diaries and manifestos. And he's not the only one. On our website at crimeresearch.org, we have literally statements from dozens of these mass murderers where they say why they pick the target that they do, but yet that part of their diaries and manifestos is continually completely ignored by the media. And my question is, isn't that newsworthy? Isn't it newsworthy why yes. these individuals pick the target that they do?
Yeah, it is, because, John, in the same way that reporters on a day-to-day basis, they'll cover a car wreck, and they'll say seatbelts were in use or seatbelts were not in use. Alcohol, there was evidence of alcohol involved in this accident, or there was not. Or they'll go to a house fire, and they'll say there was no evidence of smoke detectors or, you know, alarms that would have alerted people inside. In other words, the things that are most relevant to keeping people safe are part of the story.
Right.
And then, like you said, when you look at the things that might be involved in keeping people safe in the Minneapolis case, in others, the reporters just skip right on by it.
And that endangers people's lives, the fact they're not giving them this particular piece of information. The whole gun control debate that we have right now would be dramatically different if once in a while they'd say, well, we've had yet another mass murderer who explicitly explained why he picked the target because he wanted to go to a place where his victims were disarmed. Or that they would mention, you know, we've had 92% of these mass public shootings have occurred in places where guns are banned. My guess is the whole gun control debate, people would be calling for getting rid of these types of gun-free zones that we have. And, you know, I don't know. And with regard to the trans issue here, you know, we have to acknowledge the fact that trans, at least since 2018, are very disproportionately represented in terms of these mass public shootings. They're basically 7 times more than their share of the population in terms of the rate of committing these types of attacks. And, you know, but I have a feeling the media is doing whatever it can to try to obscure that type of fact there.
And in fact, in this case, we're told that some of the ammunition that was left behind by the shooter in Orem, Utah, was labeled with both anti-fascist messages and messages that mentioned trans. And that is a common thread of a disproportionate number of these mass shootings. That is Dr. John Lott, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Dr. Lott, thanks for the time. Back in a moment, I'll get to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. Coming up next, American schools hit bottom in student test scores. You know.
Did you know Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. American kids' test scores have hit historic lows. These are the new numbers out now about last year. While teachers are out there demanding more money for failing to teach the kids, should teachers get raises for producing some of the worst student outcomes literally in decades? I'm going to get into the details of this, and then I'll get to your phone calls. If you want to join the best conversation and talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, I put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com, and you can answer our X poll. You'll find the question every day. We put up a brand new poll question written from the news of the day. You'll find it at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. So, historic lows. And I know that the folks who run the K-12 failing government school systems in America are out there busy spinning like tops, trying to convince parents, don't take your kids out of the school. They represent dollar signs to those of us in the educational industrial complex. But consider the numbers that have come out. The National Report Card for Kids, NAEP, the National Assessment of Educational Progress, 12th grade average math scores are the worst since the current test began 20 years ago, 2005. Reading was below any point since they started doing assessments back in 1992, almost a third of a century ago. The share of 12th graders who were proficient actually slid backward 2 percentage points between 2019 and 2024. So if you want to blame this on the pandemic, good luck trying, because these test scores are sliding below the scores in 2019 before the pandemic started. So what does it show? Eighth grade science along with 12th grade math and reading. This is the first time since 2019 that results for the grade levels and subjects were released. In other words, they held back the releases. They used the excuse of the pandemic, said, well, we can't tell you the numbers right now because, you know, the pandemic screwed all of that stuff up. But consider this. Student performance nationwide is the same or lower than it was when each of the assessments was first started. Eighth grade science, 2024, no measurable difference between 2009 and present. Current eighth grade science performance is flat. 12th grade mathematics, a 3 percentage point decline over the last 20 years. So this is nothing that you can go back and blame on the pandemic. Grade 12 mathematics scores hit brand new low points. 12th grade reading, a 10 percentage point drop over the last 30 years. That's how bad it is. And as the Education Secretary Linda McMahon puts it, today's NAEP results, NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, confirms a disturbing trend. American students are testing at historic lows across all of K-12. She said nearly half of high school seniors test below basic levels in math and reading at a critical juncture when students are about to graduate and either go into the workforce, into the military, or into higher education. And what do we get from the folks in public schools? Hey, that shows we need more money. Well, except they've been getting more money. America currently spends more money than every other country on planet Earth, much more than some other countries on planet Earth. And the end result is we're still not getting progress made. Kids are sliding backwards instead of moving forwards. Let's go first to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I tuned into the show this afternoon, and you were talking about a social media post that a teacher at Neil Armstrong School had made.
Yep.
And I just kind of wanted to touch on the fact that, I've seen dozens and dozens of posts over the last, 24 hours of people praising this horrific act. And I think that one thing that we're all noticing is these people are about to experience something that they've never experienced in their life, and that's accountability for their actions.
I think you're right.
I've seen a lot of people take down their social media in hopes of retracting what they did or said or any of that. And what they don't know is that we live in a digital world, and once you put something on the internet, it exists there forever.
Yep.
And so these people have lost their jobs, and their livelihood is about to change. Who knows how long a simple statement is going to follow them around?
And in fact, I think it should. And Jason, I want to ask your opinion on this, because one of the excuses I'm hearing from the schools is, well, this is a private statement by an American citizen who's a teacher, and they're outside of work hours and they're on their own social media, but it goes public. So I'd ask you this. What do you suppose happens to a kid at a school if he goes on social media outside of school hours on his own social media account and uses the N-word to describe his classmates? What do you suppose happens? Do you suppose the school ignores that?
I don't know, Lars. I think that, honestly, I think the kid would probably have the same consequences as you or I. I mean, if I walked around with a T-shirt that had a swastika on it with something that, you know, a hat that had my employer's name on it, I don't think that I would have a job the next day when I went to work.
I don't think you would. And what I'm trying to say is the schools are telling me, because the teacher said it outside of school hours on their own social media, but social media, as you know, you say, well, it's a private account. Look, like you said, once something's on the internet, if you assume you can tear it down, you can't. It's forever. And number two, if you assume it only went to the group of people I share space with, the problem is they can all share it with everybody else, and routinely it does. It's what we try to warn young girls and boys about. You take naked pictures of yourself, put them on social media, they are going to be there forever. It is virtually impossible to remove them. So when I hear the schools say, well, this wasn't on school time or on an official website of the school, I think that's a really lousy excuse. They're trying to say the teacher has a right to say in their own, you know, private world what they want to say. That's never been the rule in America. I mean, I still remember there was an NBA owner. I can't remember his name now, but he apparently used the N-word liberally, but in private conversations. When that became public, all of a sudden the NBA said, you don't own a team. You know, you're not allowed to own a team anymore. I mean, there are lots and lots of things that even if you say them on your own time, you know, and outside of work hours, it shouldn't matter, because then you have to ask parents, do you want a teacher standing in front of your kids who celebrates the death of a citizen of the United States like that?
Yeah, I don't know, Lars. I think the whole thing's horrific, honestly.
It very much is, and I appreciate the call. Let me go to Jason. Jason, if you got a quick theory for us, go ahead. We're close to the break.
Yeah, you know, Lars, it's got to be the usual suspects, you know, the same people who got Epstein, you know. I mean, what's up with all the neck wounds?
You mean the same people who got Epstein? You think the young man who apparently may have done the shooting yesterday is the same guy who got Epstein?
It's the usual suspects. You know, they're creating polarization. They're trying to dissolve bipartisanship. I mean, it was the neck wound that started World War One. It was Prince Ferdinand that got shot in the neck.
A deliberate assassination of somebody for political reasons. I agree with that. But the idea that they're trying to create polarization, you don't think there's polarization right now when you've got half the country who don't have half the polls right now, the Democrats, accusing Donald Trump of being a Nazi, of calling ICE the Gestapo, of saying anybody who supports Trump is a Nazi supporter? I think I know where the division is coming from. The division is coming from the political left, and the inspiration for violence is coming from there as well, and they need to knock it off and understand the consequences of what they're doing. Jason, thanks for the call. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. About 10 years ago, when Donald Trump announced that he was running for president, then about 5 months later, that I announced that I was going to endorse his candidacy. Not that my endorsement made the difference or anything, but I believed in him as a president. He did a great job the first term. I think he's doing a great job in the second term. But I always told you that for my audience, I would always tell you if I disagree with President Trump. Couple of the things that I've seen recently that I don't entirely agree with, and I don't think they're a great idea. The government took a 10% stake in the chip-making high-tech company called Intel and became its largest single shareholder. And I said, I don't want the government to be the biggest investor or a controlling shareholder in major American private companies. So I thought I'd put that notion to David Bahnsen, who's founder of the Bahnsen Group, and he also contributes on Fox Business. David, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Is it a good idea for the government, any government, especially the government of a company that's not a that's not in a private in a communist country, to take a major stake in a private company?
No, it is not. And I would say the same thing if it was a minor stake, because I think even a minor stake, when the shareholder who has the stake is the most powerful entity in the world, it distorts markets. It distorts the way a free economy is supposed to work. It puts implied pressure on a whole lot of economic actors to treat that company differently when one of their shareholders, at a, whether a minor or major level, is the world's economic and military superpower. They are the regulatory overseer, the taxing authority of every business in the United States. And so it now distorts counterparties that may feel a pressure to do business with Intel. It puts an incredible pressure on the government to support Intel when it may be unwise to do so. It leaves us susceptible to moral hazard. But, you know, I don't even have to make all these arguments, Lars, because the right has already been making them for years and years and years in everything we criticize China for.
Yep.
You know, as a professional money manager, we frequently are looking at portfolios and saying, well, there's a little too high a percentage of companies here that are what we call SOEs, state-owned enterprises. And we think that companies that are privately owned perform better than companies that are state-owned. So we've just, we everybody intuitively knows that government-run businesses are less opportunistic, less dynamic, and now we are flirting with some of this here in the United States. It's really quite disappointing.
So tell me this, David, why is the Trump administration doing it? Because I honestly didn't think that Donald Trump or a government under his direction would be likely to do something like this. It's, in fact, it, at the time it happened, I thought, I'm going to check that story. That doesn't sound real. And then it turned out it was real. Why are they doing it?
Well, I think that there's two different answers, because initially I had thought this is just a very bad idea that's a one-off, that they just are mistakenly believing, hey, let's take CHIPS Act money and instead of doing a grant to Intel, let's turn it into equity. And, you know, I'm with you. There's a lot of things I like that the president does. There are some things I don't like, and I feel morally compelled to call balls and strikes. And I don't think that the president is very ideologically committed to some of these things. And so if it were a one-off where he just thought, yeah, I don't think it's a big deal for the government to take a stake here, this is a man who likes to announce deals. He's a very transactional person in both his business and governmental life. I don't agree with it. I don't like it. But I could kind of just say, well, it's one deal and I hope it's the last. But then in the 2 and 3 days that followed, we saw Kevin Hassett, the National Economic Council director, say the government wants to start a whole sovereign wealth fund, a portfolio of companies that the government takes an ownership in. Secretary of Commerce Howard Lutnick said, you know, Lockheed Martin sells the government a lot of its supplies and tanks and missiles. We may as well become an owner of Lockheed Martin.
Do they not see, David, don't they see the conflict of interest? Because, for example, if it's Lockheed Martin and you say, we're going to take an ownership stake, so they own a stake to 5%, 10%, pretty significant. And then a contract comes up and the Pentagon is told, we need to buy some new planes. Who should we buy them from? Well, you know, the boss or the government owns a big chunk of this company. If we don't buy them from that company, then their interest go down. The equity might go down if we buy from their competitors. So we better buy from the one that's owned by the company. It biases not just the government's attitude toward that company, but all of its purchasing and other actions, doesn't it?
Well, it certainly does. And even if it doesn't, just the mere potential of it distorts markets. It leads to the perception of suboptimal deals. And so it, no matter what, is a finger on the scale that is problematic for a free enterprise economy. But of course, you know, Lord Acton taught us power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. It's impossible that it wouldn't lead to a conflict because of human nature. It's impossible that it wouldn't distort decision-making, which is one of the reasons we've always had big laws against various embedded governmental conflicts with business.
I will tell you something, David, that's always troubled me. And I constantly hear politicians, both on the right and the left, saying, why the public is going to make an investment in this or an investment in that. And we're always making investments in things that nobody else wants to invest in, which is why they want the government's money. And number two, I say, if that's our investment, if it loses money, we lose money, right? And they say, yeah, you know, like Solyndra. And if it makes money, we don't make any money. That sounds like a really bad investment when you call it. And so don't call it an investment. Say we're going to gift the money to Solyndra, or we're going to gift the money to Intel. And so I've kind of wished, if the government is going to tell me my taxpayer money is going to be invested there, I want to know what the public makes back, except I don't want the government to own a piece of the company either.
Well, that's right, but I want to point something out. So Solyndra was getting money because they lost a bunch of money and were applying for needs-based help because of a green environmental agenda. Intel makes $10 billion, okay? This is just rank corporate welfare. So what is the reason that that we are going to be able to say no next time the left wants to do Solyndra? If the right does it for Intel, the left is sure as heck going to do it for some environmental company or ESG or DEI or whatever their own social or political or cultural agenda may be. So we're really setting a trap that I think is going to be very difficult for us to get out of when inevitably at some point the other side says, well, why don't we use government money, which is called taxpayer money, last I checked, to do something that's even more tear-jerking. Look, the other thing that we haven't even touched on yet is how they're paying for it. How does an entity with $37 trillion of debt take a $10 billion investment? The entire point of the $37 trillion of debt is that they not only don't have any money, they have negative $37 trillion of money.
So what they could do is they could invest in paying off our debt, which has an immediate result. If they'd taken the money that they used to buy a stake in Intel and used it to pay down the debt, at least we'd be paying less interest. Not much less, but some less anyway.
And then, of course, there are some who will say, well, David, maybe that's what will happen, is that they will make money on the Intel investment and then we'll be better off. But what's the limiting principle there? Why not go be big investors in Apple? Why not run your own hedge fund? Well, because of the corruption, because of the division of labor, because it's not the government's role. You know, I just got done this afternoon reviewing a $400 million portfolio for a city that my company was reviewing its finances. The only thing they're allowed to own is government securities, you know, principal protected treasury bonds.
Things like that. David Bahnsen is the founder of the Bahnsen Group. David, I appreciate the time. Frequent Fox Business contributor and also comes on our show. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk at LarsLarsen.com. You've got the Radio Northwest Network. For me.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larsen Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Always glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Well, it sounds like an awful lot of people are getting in trouble for the comments that they're making about the assassination of Charlie Kirk yesterday, including at least one school teacher and apparently now perhaps a city council member here in the Pacific Northwest. In any case, glad to get those calls. Let me go first to a naysayer call, and that's Wolf. Hey, Wolf, what do you want to disagree about that makes you a naysayer today?
Well, I disagree with the premise that teachers shouldn't be striking for better wages and benefits. strictly based on student performance. I looked up some stats right before the call, and the average or median wage, an average wage for teachers, starting teachers with a fresh bachelor's degree, fresh certification starting, is approximately $50,000. That's about $25 an hour on a 2,000-hour year. With minimum wage in the Portland area being $16 an hour, that's not much of a difference for 4 years of school.
The difference also, between $16 an hour and $25 is not much. I'd call it $18,000, and you're doing that based on a full-time year. Teachers don't work a full-time year. Their contracts specify 1,500 hours of work per year.
Okay.
It's a three-quarter time job with generous vacation and generous benefits. So if you think they should go on strike, now there is a difference. In Washington State, teacher strikes are illegal. Should they still go on strike?
No, it's illegal.
Okay, but they do it anyway. And in Oregon, if you have a contract to work and you don't show up to fulfill that contract, what should your employer do with you?
Breach of contract.
What's that?
Yeah, correct. That would be a breach of contract.
Right.
But I'm talking about just the sheer economics of teaching.
But hold on. You're doing something weird with wages, though, Wolf, because you're saying, I've decided I want to do this for a living, and I want it to make a comfortable living for me. Well, that isn't the way it works, is it? If I said someday, I want to throw clay pots instead of doing talk radio, but I want throwing clay pots to pay enough to generously support my lifestyle. That's not how you get your wage. You get your wage based on right. supply and demand and the skills and talent right. you bring to the job, right?
Correct.
And do we have any shortage of teachers right now?
Yes.
No, we don't. Every single teaching job in Oregon and Washington, at least in this region, is full, and they have other teachers who'd like to get into the profession. So if your boss said, boy, I got people coming out of the woodwork who want to work this job, you say, well, maybe you're paying too much. And he says, well, I'll bring the wages down. I've still got a lot of applicants. If your boss is getting lots of applicants at, say, $20 an hour, does he need to pay 30?
No, I see the point there.
Okay.
When you look at what a teacher does, what their certifications have to do, and the fact that if you don't have teachers, then you're paying a babysitter, okay? Babysitters average around $20 to $22 an hour in the area. So between a babysitter and a teacher, just the wage is not that big of a gap. When you look at new college...
Sounds like there isn't much difference in the skills then, is there?
There
I know I'm going to get people hating me for saying that, but Wolf, do you know a lot of people who, do you know any people who homeschool their kids?
Yes, I have.
Are they generally dumber or smarter than public school students you also know?
It depends on the student and the environment.
Now, I know there are individual differences, but on balance, what do you
on
find
balance,
that the kids who are homeschooled or the kids who are government schooled are better prepared and smarter? Which one?
Generally the homeschool, because the industrialized education system is just meant to give compliant workers.
And by the way, did you hear the NAEP numbers that I mentioned earlier about where the kids mm-hmm. are? That half the kids can't do math, half the kids can't read, half the kids scored, they're scoring 50% in the science area. Does it sound like they're doing a great job in the government schools?
Now, if you look at the various variables on why that
question,
could be, one of them could be the fact that the lower wages are not attracting the better talent and
lower wages.
Talent.
Do you know? You looked at the bottom end entry point, but I can take the bottom end entry point of almost any profession in the world, and it looks low. But if you take I think the last time I looked up the average wage of a Portland teacher for a part-time job, that's a part-time job. That's how I define 1,500 hours a year. It's about $80,000 a year with a generous benefits package. Are those low wages?
When you look at the total compensation, no. When you look at just the strict cash wage?
No, all you looked at was the entry-level job, right? Because if you look
right,
at, compared you know, what is a big...
I compared it with the stat of what is the median...
wage in the U.S. for a new bachelor's degree, and that's $68,000. Granted, that goes across tech, that goes across all the different bachelor's degrees.
Yeah, it does. However, and so you're comparing apples to oranges, and you're comparing full-time work to part-time work, right? Sounds like you've correct. Got apples to oranges all day long.
It's not necessarily apples to oranges. It's just
and then how about this? If you worked in tech and 50% of your product was crap, would you keep your job? If you work in education and 50% of your kids can read, would you keep your job?
Right. Now, why is it that 50% of the kids can't read up to level?
What? Because I would blame the education system.
Lars. 15 seconds, we'll be on the air. Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and it's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment, but forgive me if I sum it up this way. The state of Oregon's population is shrinking. Your kids' schools are failing despite record spending, and housing costs keep going up. Is Oregon on its way down the drain? I thought we'd talk about that with a guy who knows these issues well, and that's John Taponia, who's a senior policy analyst at Eco Northwest. John, welcome to the program, or I should say welcome back.
All right, thank you.
Tell me this. I summed it up that way. Am I being unfair to the state? Because the region has its share of problems right now. Population's an issue for both Oregon and Washington, business as well, tax costs and everything else. Are we on a downward spiral?
So downward spiral, I don't know, but certainly at risk of stagnation and standing still. We're just in a place that is completely unfamiliar to us. I think most people's mindset is this is a beautiful place. It's like we're back in the 70s. People are going to be rushing in. We're going to grow by, 25% in a decade. That's just not where we are or where this country is right now. This is an older, much less mobile country than it has been. Population is slowing down a lot all the way across the country. And so Oregon is now in a position where it's going to have to compete for talent and population in a way that is unfamiliar to us.
Because, John, when you say 25% over 10 years, that's 2.5% a year. Does that sound like
that
something
was that was back in the 70s.
Oh, that wasn't.
That's when Tom McCall got up and said, visit but don't stay. That's what was coming at us. We had just finished the interstate highway system. People discovered our mountains and coasts, and we didn't want to have California-style sprawl. So we created a whole bunch of sort of machinery in the 70s to tame and slow down that growth. Depending on who you talk to, people like some of those outcomes. That did slow things down some. We don't have strip malls all the way from Portland to Salem, and so that's a good thing. But that machinery that we built then to deal with those problems from 50 years ago is not the same machinery that we need now in an era of much slower population growth going forward.
Well, and it sounds like some of that machinery you're talking about is land use planning, urban growth boundaries, comprehensive land use planning, that kind of stuff, right?
It's that, and it is business regulation. We're the seventh most highly regulated business regulation state in the country, according to George Mason University. And I'm not saying regulation has its place. The land use regulations certainly have their place. To keep them unchanged exactly as they are today, I think would create a big economic headwind for us going forward.
Well, in fact, you've got a governor right now, and Tina Kotek, I didn't support her, but she said, I'll come in and I'll double the amount of housing that's being built because the state is woefully short of the housing needed to house its population, even with growth slowed down. And instead of doubling, my understanding is the numbers have dropped in half instead. So she actually went backwards when she was claiming that she was going to get a lot more housing built. And a lot of the reasons it's not being built, at least by my estimation, are taxes and regulation from the government that keep the people who would ordinarily build housing and who make money doing it from actually getting it done. Do you think she recognizes that?
You know, I think the governor and previously a speaker deserves an awful lot of credit for some pretty bold nation-leading reforms, like allowing more multifamily housing in neighborhoods that used to be exclusively zoned for single-family zoning. She has advanced some pretty bold initiatives and has just recently released some rulemaking that will sort of work with cities to set production goals and hold them accountable if they're not meeting them. Right now, the macroeconomy, we've got high interest rates, we've got high construction costs, we've got tight labor markets, et cetera. The macroeconomy is not working in her favor. That's not to say that there isn't more to do on the production side, but the macro conditions at the moment are not in the favor of building.
Yeah, and if that's the case and she can't get the housing built, then are young people going to have any choice but to move out, and then that just accelerates the population loss?
Yeah, no, you do. She knows it, and it is her top priority is to get those numbers up. And, you know, we've gone through probably three different rounds now of housing policy change in the state of Oregon, and it's time for maybe a little bit more policy, but an awful lot more focus on implementation and trying to figure out what's left that's getting in the way.
John Taponia is with me, senior policy advisor at Eco Northwest. So, John, what about this? Portland now ranks as the second highest marginal tax rate in any American city in the country, and New York is the only one that's higher. Is that a good idea?
That's right. Yeah, no, that does pose a challenge. So if you've got urban public finance theory would say that if you have a small geography like a city of Portland inside a larger metropolitan area, and you have highly differential taxes and services being delivered within that metropolitan area, that people do have a choice to be able to move around a little bit. So, you know, somebody could move from Portland to Clark County, Washington, or down to Clackamas County, Oregon, and they have the same access to labor if they're a business. They have the same access to, you know, Mount Hood and the coast. They have the same access to the highway systems and access to markets, et cetera. So you have the ability to sort of shop within a metropolitan area. And I think at a minimum, there is a threat to Portland's economy, the city of Portland's economy, with having a tax rate and service delivery posture that is as far out of line as it is with its neighbors.
Okay, in the last minute or so, John, any suggestions on education? Oregon spends almost $18,000 per student per year. That's more than college, yeah. And it's producing terrible results, at least based on the test scores. What should they do to change that?
Yeah, this is one of the bigger shocks as I sort of look at the data, because I've worked a lot in this space. You know, we lived under a federal accountability system, No Child Left Behind, and then Barack Obama came in with Race to the Top. But that federal accountability largely lifted in 2015-2016. That focus on testing, the focus on individual schools, are they making adequate yearly progress, et cetera. In Oregon, nothing took its place, or very little took its place in terms of getting data out there transparently and in intervening in schools if kids were falling behind. The legislature and the governor did just pass an accountability bill in the most recent session.
And that may make a difference. That's John Taponia, who is a senior policy analyst at Eco Northwest. John, thank you very much. Coming up in a moment, Congress wants to give legal status to illegal alien farm workers. Should Congress reward people for skipping the line? That's next.
What does Lars think about smoking the devil's lettuce?
I won't go schizo, will I?
There's a distinct possibility.
Now it's time to take a hit of Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Naysayers always go to the head of the line, of course. Is Congress going to now reward people for skipping the line and coming to America illegally? The reason I ask that is that overnight there was a story that broke from the Center Square, and I check the Center Square all the time. They do some good journalism. Bipartisan lawmakers have reintroduced a bill designed to give immigrant farm workers, meaning illegal aliens, an opportunity to pursue temporary legal status in the United States. I want to emphasize some of those terms. Temporary, meaning you come here, you're not a green card holder, but you might work here for a time and then go back to your real home. And who is it being introduced again by? Republican Dan Newhouse of Washington, Zoe Lofgren from California, Mike Simpson, a Republican from Idaho, David Valadao, Republican of California, and Adam Gray, Democrat of California. Now, they're worried about the workforce for agriculture. The current estimate from the U.S. Department of Ag is that 42% of farm workers do not have legal status. I can do the math. That means 58% of the farm workers are in the United States legally. Now, why don't you fill all those farm jobs with other legal workers? Well, right now, there's no cap on the number of H-2A visas that can be issued in a single year. In 2023, the State Department issued 750,000 H-2A visas to workers, a sevenfold increase from 2005. So what does this boil down to? They're worried that Donald Trump's deportation of illegal aliens is going to leave the farms without the cheap labor they had before. Now, this has usually been a Democrat issue, but apparently Republicans have said, well, we got to make a way for some of these illegals to stay in the United States and continue to do the work. Some of the promises you should watch out for. If you say this is only temporary legal status, not a path to a green card, because otherwise what you're telling everybody who stood in line, and many people on planet Earth want to come to the United States. We allow more than 1 million people to come here legally every year on a green card. And within 5 years, that's a path for you to become a U.S. citizen. If you don't commit crimes and if you do the right things and if you keep employed, you can then apply for to take the test and then swear the oath and become a U.S. citizen. You're skipping these people past all of those people. Now, you want to ask yourself whether or not you think that is right or not in order to supply the farms with workers. The second question might be, if you've read history, you understand that the farmers in the southern part of the United States back when slavery was common said, we can't operate these farms without our slave labor. To me, this argument is very reminiscent of that. If you don't give us illegal aliens to work, we're going to have to pay more to get Americans to do this work or to automate this work. So give us a steady supply of illegal aliens and decide whether or not you're morally comfortable with that. In any case, glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me go first to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It is 9-11, and I take it you have a special memory of what happened on 9-11.
I do, but really quickly, I want to say I appreciate your voice, Lars, and especially in the light of the Charlie Kirk shooting, conservative political voices are challenged these days, and so I appreciate everything that you do for the Northwest. Sometimes I feel like I'm alone. I turn on the radio, and I hear somebody else at least understand part of what I'm thinking. So thank you for what you do, and I hope you're
it's
safe out
pleasure.
There. I also wanted to say really quickly about Aaron Danielson from 5 years ago, a little over 5 years ago. He was another political assassination right here in Portland, and Trump brought swift justice to his killer, so my memories are of him. But I was just going to say, back in 2000, I lived in La Mesa, California, which is a suburb of San Diego, and I went on a daily basis to my local gas station near the freeway, which is where these the terrorists actually worked when they were taking their flying lessons at a local airport and going to a local mosque. And I interacted with these folks, at least two to three of them, if not more, on a fairly regular basis, at least over a dozen times. times. And my memory of them was they interacted very little. They were very, very unfriendly. They had dark black hole eyes, and they ended up being the ones that flew the plane into the 9/11. So I'll never forget. And for those people who don't think that immigration and customs enforcement is important in the United States, it's absolutely important. And I'll never, ever forget. And I'm very untrusting of immigrants at this point in my life, and I think I always will be.
Well, Chris, one of the things I'd add to that is because I covered 9/11 and from a distance, but back, you know, when the terrorist attacks happened, we found out that those 19 hijackers had between them 63 different driver's licenses. And if you say, well, how did we not become aware that these people were in the country? They'd come in, and I think in some cases on tourist visas and other kinds of easy visas to get. And then they got picture ID throughout America. So when I heard people complaining most recently about having to get real ID to be able to take an airplane flight somewhere, that you say, well, hold on. This was all passed in the aftermath of 9/11. And so asking you to go down and show that you are an American citizen or you have a legal status in the United States to get a picture ID seems common sense. After what happened, except I think people are forgetting what happened on 9/11. And so they passed the Real ID Act a few years later and then gave most of America a pass on actually complying with Real ID. And you say, don't you realize that one of the things that allowed those men to do what they did was that they could get multiple pieces of picture ID for themselves and their cohort, 63 among the 19 hijackers, and then they murdered almost 3,000 people. And he say, you don't remember when that happened? That's a problem.
Yeah, 3,000 years, 3,000 lives too late. But the fact of the matter is that I had the opportunity to meet them face to face. And in retrospect, looking back on that, I was just shocked to learn the news. And anybody who, you know, it's a very familiar location in La Mesa, California now. They call it Terrorist Texaco colloquially. But it was just sad to know that those people were there and always wondering if there wasn't something I did or could have done or could have done to avoided it. But unfortunately, ended up in the loss of 3,000 American lives. So,
but don't we wish right now that the intelligence agencies that knew there might be an attack but didn't know the specifics, and the other agencies that knew there were people who were weirdly trying to learn how to fly a plane flat and level but not how to take off or land a commercial jetliner, and they said, why didn't you put that together? And the answer was the agencies weren't talking to each other. Chris, thanks for the call. Let's go to Rudy. Hey, Rudy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I have a comment about the teacher that made a posting off hours and on his own computer.
Yeah.
So what's not going to happen?
Celebrating the murder of Charlie Kirk, yeah.
You're right. What would happen if somebody sees that posting and says, hey, I'm going to take this guy out? Now, they know which school he works at. What's stopped them from going to that school and taking him out?
Yeah, except staff, Rudy, my concern is, you know, that teacher says what he wants to say. But the fact that the school says we're still comfortable with somebody who's celebrating the murder of somebody, in this case, Charlie Kirk, because of his political views. And I would just ask you, how many parents would say, oh, I'd love to have a teacher with my young kids in a middle school, a teacher who celebrates when somebody gets murdered in the United States simply because of his politics? Are you comfortable having your kids in front of that teacher? And I would tell you, I would guess that most sensible parents would say, I don't want that teacher anywhere near a classroom. Yet, you know what Neil Armstrong Middle School said? They said, well, he posted it on his own social media account, and he did it outside of work hours, so it's really not our business. Would you react that way if he worked for your private company? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Facebook, X, and Google may censor you, but you'll never find censorship here.
Don't censor me!
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, 24 years after the deadliest attack on American soil, what does a 9/11 survivor want every generation to remember? And has our nation honored the unity that was born on that day and that died not too long after that? Do we think that America is safer today than it was on September the 10th of 2001? Rob Manis is a retired colonel, host of the Rob Manis Show, and founder of Gator Pack. Colonel Manis, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with the simple part of this. Are we safer now because of what we know happened 24 years ago and what we did in response to it, or are we not? Are we still too complacent?
Unfortunately, we're not, my friend. You know, the country has been infiltrated by Islamists throughout the years, as we were all pointed outward, fighting Al-Qaeda and destroying ISIS under the first Trump administration, and trying to do whatever that mission was in the late part of the war in Afghanistan that ended in disaster. We've been importing Islamists into this country. And what's known as the Red-Green Axis, the Marxist-Islamist Axis, has got a foothold in our politics now. The Democrat mayor nominee is a Red-Green Axis Marxist-Islamist. That's where he's from. So we have some internal defense issues that we need to take serious look at and address before we move too much further forward.
Well, and how about members of Congress who are Islamists, who say that their first loyalty is not to the United States of America, but is to Somalia or some other country?
Yeah, it's unconscionable when you think about it. And when my family and I look at what's happening today, and, you know, my one of my sons wasn't even born yet, but my adult children are all appalled what we're seeing, and some of them went on to serve in the global war on terrorism and other missions during that time frame too. We really got to take a serious look at it. We've got to look at dual citizenship and banning that for people holding elected office, like in our federal Congress, the ones that you just mentioned. There is no way that a sitting elected official should be declaring allegiance to anything except for the Constitution of the United States and the society that makes up the United States and the values that underpin that Constitution, which are Christian-based. We have to be honest about that. Look, you know, the assassination of Charlie Kirk was much more than a political assassination. It was a Christian martyrdom. He'd been talking out against Islamism for quite some time and had made some recent comments that told me that he got it and he understood what was happening in this country. So we've got a big issue to look at from an internal defense perspective as we face threats like the People's Republic of China from the outside. And again, that Red-Green Axis is being taken advantage of by the Chinese Communist Party. You know, these kids that are out here protesting in support of the Hamas Nazis that did the atrocities in Israel on October 7th are affected by these hundreds of thousands of communist Chinese students and business people and other types of folks that are in this country legally, and the 100,000 or so Chinese military age males that came in this country under the Biden administration through that open southern border and through other various means. All of those people are working on behalf of the Chinese Communist Party, and they are unmonitored for the most part, undetected, and they are operating to influence the young people of America. Charlie Kirk was effective as an American and as a Christian father and husband, and effective at influencing several generations of young men and women.
And that's what they were afraid of, isn't it?
And that's exactly what they were afraid of, and that's exactly why he has now been killed, murdered, executed, really, in public, just to make the point. And I'm sure that we're going to see that the tools that they use for this operation are very similar to the ones they tried to use on Donald J. Trump and the two assassination attempts for him. They're left-leaning, progressive, probably affiliated with Antifa and the transgender movement of some sort. Bits of information are starting to come out from the investigation that lead me to believe that's exactly it. And we have people in this country that are celebrating the man's death. So we have major issues that, unfortunately, my generation let develop while we were supposed to be eliminating the threat of Islamism.
I'm talking to Colonel Rob Manis. You know, Colonel, at least early on, we're only about 24 hours since the assassination of Charlie Kirk, but one of my biggest concerns is that we're seeing teachers who came out on social media in the last 24 hours not all of them, and certainly not even the majority, but a lot of them who were celebrating the murder of an American. And now we have school districts that are, in some cases, defending it. Florida's actually issued a memo and said, we're going to go out. If you've posted something despicable on social media, we're going to do an investigation. But most of the rest of the states are effectively defending it, saying, well, you know, if they're, if it's outside of work hours and it's on their own social media, then it really doesn't affect their job. Do Americans really accept the idea that a teacher of young children, like middle school children, would be able to say, I celebrated, it brightened my day, as one teacher posted yesterday, that Charlie Kirk had died. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, I don't ever celebrate the death of liberal politicians or liberal political figures. And yet you've got the teachers of young children doing it and school districts who say, yeah, as long as they did it on their own time, that's okay.
Yeah, and that's the difference between these people that are not human. They're not human on the other side, Lars. Fortunately, I live in Mississippi. The chancellor of Ole Miss fired a professor that was publicly making those kind of statements, fired him this morning. She was doing them last night, fired him this morning. But this will frighten you. There are hundreds of military personnel officers and non-commissioned officers that are making those kind of comments. There are a couple of accounts on X that are finding them, rooting them out, and identifying them to the War Department and the Secretary of War's office. And that should bother you, because anybody that's celebrating the death of a man like Charlie Kirk, who was teaching the Constitution of the United States, every one of those individuals took an oath to support and defend with their life, if needed, to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And they are celebrating the fact that a man that was peacefully, civilly and respectfully encouraging debate amongst those that oppose his ideas, and using his ideas and the ideas of America to persuade them, and successfully did so many times. They're celebrating that man's death. Those people shouldn't be in the United States military if that's what they think. Colonel, they're violating their oath of office.
The UCMJ, and the very fact that these people thought, I can say this and there won't be any consequence, suggests they're not all that smart either, doesn't it?
It sure does, and we've seen that really they're not all that smart. They think they are, but they're not.
Unbelievable. And you know, I just, look, there are times where people leave political office, either leave under their own power. I mean, Joe Biden left under his own power. I was glad to see him leave political office. Do I wish evil for him? Do I wish an untimely end for him? I don't. Never have and never will. And the fact that there are groups of people in this country that do that kind of thing, that say, well, we want somebody killed. I mean, this is why AOC just finished saying, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez just said, a man who spent his entire career, she was referring to Kirk, campaigning against gun safety. What she means is more government gun control, you know, has nobody but himself to blame. This is a member of Congress saying the fact that he didn't want to have one more to add to the 20,000 gun laws there already, then makes Charlie Kirk the victim of his own doing. And that's an evil thing to say. And yet I'm willing to bet her own Democrat Party will not call her out. That's Colonel Rob Manis, who served this country in uniform. He is the founder of Gator Pack and the host of the Rob Manis Show. Hey, Rob, thank you very much. Colonel, it's a pleasure, as always, to have you on. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
The risks and rewards of remote work.
Where are you now?
I'm sitting in my office.
I doubt that.
Why would you doubt that?
If you were in your office right now, we'd be having this conversation face to face.
At least woke progressives won't stop you from listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network, proudly serving the Pacific Northwest states for more than 25 years with honestly provocative talk. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers. The regenerative medical specialists are Oregon Medical Centers. Oh, and by the way, our X-Poll today. Should we send a message with the death penalty for those who commit acts of political murder, no matter how you want to define those? And in fact, I'm glad that one of my callers mentioned Aaron Danielson, who was murdered on the streets of downtown Portland simply because he was a Trump supporter. And that happened during that terrible year of riots in 2020. And you say, okay, well, in his case, his killer actually got the death penalty because as the federal marshals tried to take him into custody, he shot at the federal marshals. They shot back and his life was ended. But should we have the death penalty for those who commit political acts of political murder, no matter which side they're going against? I would say yes. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Phil, listening on the Radio Northwest Network on in the Rogue River area. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program, and what's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I just wanted to talk about that temp status for immigrants about farm work.
Yeah, where there's a bipartisan effort, that means both Republicans and Democrats have jumped onto it. This bill that was reintroduced about in the last 24 hours that would give temporary legal status to so-called immigrant farm workers, meaning illegal aliens, because they're legally here. They don't have to have temporary status. What do you think of that idea? Because I don't like it.
Well, and as you well said earlier, that temporary is not going to be temporary.
Nope.
However, I had, like, let's just say an epiphany. And I gave you a call, and nobody seems to know what to do with the homeless, correct?
I think I know where you're going, but yeah.
What if we had some kind of legal internal deportation to take some of these able-bodied homeless folks that actually would want to work and get out of their current situation to the farms? And work the farms.
The problem is, Phil, if you're going to do that against their will, number one is whether or not you're capable of putting a fentanyl addict or a heroin addict or a methamphetamine addict to any kind of meaningful work. That'd be problem one. Problem two, though, would be problem one, is that are you talking about indentured servitude where the government would force you to work a job? If you were homeless, you can't be homeless. Illegal. We're gonna take you out to the farm and put you to work.
But I wonder how many of those folks would actually volunteer for that kind of thing to get out of their situation.
To get out of the fentanyl, I think if you're a fentanyl addict or a meth addict, I think your biggest concern at every minute of the day is getting your next hit. And I don't think it's anything about getting a job. I think some of them, maybe when they're sober, say, oh, I don't want to be on drugs, but I'm addicted to them. But I'm not sure how you get them off of that unless you force them to go off of that. And if you say, well, how do you force somebody to do that? In the past, all they had to do was say, would you like a felony conviction for possession or distribution of a controlled substance? The judges would say, you can either have the felony conviction or you can go into treatment. You go into a program and agree to try and stay drug free. That worked like a charm. And then the liberals said, no, we don't want to do that. We're going to reduce it to either no crime at all or a misdemeanor. And now you have lots and lots of people who won't go into treatment. They tried this deflection nonsense. Multnomah County has had a couple of dozen people that have actually gone into treatment as a result. But largely it's been unsuccessful and a big waste of time and money. Phil, thanks for the call. Elma in Kenmore, Washington, welcome to the program. Are you a naysayer today?
Yeah, I'm a naysayer. Look like
I know you disagree with everything I say, but...
But you know what? Not everything. But you know what, my friend? I would, God forbid, that any Republicans or people who condemn these homeless ever have to live in their shoes, ever have to walk in their shoes.
They won't, because Republicans have jobs.
Wait, they don't know how they got there. They might have been lawyers and doctors, people with lies. They never know that you might have a relative that walked that way. Have a little pity. I pity what happened to Mr. Kirk, even though he said a lot of rude things, but that was his platform, right?
You know what? God bless you for having that attitude, Elma, because you realize a lot of other Democrats like you are out celebrating Charlie Kirk's murder.
You don't celebrate anybody. The man had a family. He had children. And that's what That's why I respect you, Lawrence, for letting me come in, because you let me at least speak my piece.
Your phone broke up, Elma. Elma, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, because your phone broke up for a moment. Elma, you are probably my favorite naysayer, because we have nice conversations, and I'm glad to hear you say, I wish the Democrats would stop talking about how they're happy that Charlie Kirk is dead. I think that's, the day that Joe Biden passes, whether it's tomorrow or 10 years from now, I am not going to celebrate Joe Biden's passing,
though
I think he was a bad guy.
Thank you. And the same thing about Trump. I don't celebrate death of anyone. It's so violent for one thing, and we never know what the next minute brings for us.
And good for you, Elma. Elma, today you're not a naysayer. That is Elma from Kenmore, Washington. Back in a moment, it is Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson.